I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. Now, to control the past, they edited history. To control the future, they edited literature. The words of my guest today, the author Jane Fine. And while they belong to the setting of her brilliant thriller, Widowland, for many, these words have unsettlingly felt closer to the world of facts than they do to fiction. Little wonder then that Widowland was chosen by the Times as its book of the month, adding to a claim including the mantle of the most important feminist novel in decades. Jane, welcome to Changemakers.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I've read the book. I've loved it. I want to, though, for you to introduce it in your own words. Let's start. There's a coronation in 1953, a lovely summer's day in London at Westminster Abbey. That all sounds very familiar, but it's not Queen Elizabeth, is it?
It's not Queen Elizabeth. So I remember my parents telling me about the coronation and how everybody got a television for the first time for that particular ceremony and how exciting and seminal it was. And yet I've always been haunted by the what if, one of the big what ifs of the 20th century, which is what if Edward VIII had continued as king and there had been an alliance, as would probably have been the case, between England and Nazi Germany. And so I decided to flip history at that point, and we've got a coronation which is of Edward and Wallace, and they have waited 13 years for the leader to come over to watch the coronation. They've effectively been king and queen, but they decided to wait until he could be present. And now that's come about, and our protagonist, who's called Rose Ranson, who works in the culture ministry, is awaiting the big day.
Mm. And it's an amazing moment, actually, when you bring to life what the dress rehearsal might have been like. Wallace doesn't particularly come across as a great lover of the institution or indeed the country in the preparations. I mean, how much of this was based on factual research, or how much did you just sort of think, well, this is how I imagined them to be?
Oh, so much was based on factual research. The point being was that I'd written 10 novels before this, which were very much based factually in pre-war and wartime Germany. And so I'd spent more than a decade, living effectively, imaginatively in that world. And so much of it I was able to import into my alternative history in Widowland. The most important, and the point at which Widowland was inspired really, came about in the person of Alfred Rosenberg, who was, in real life, he was a crazy philosopher guru known to Hitler, and he'd been obsessed with England, and one of his obsessions was that England and Germany shared the same racial soul, and he always wanted, should an alliance happen, to be given the protectorate of Britain. And this has come about in Widowland. But the reason I was very interested, what actually triggered the kind of germ of this story, was that one of the things that Rosenberg did in the war was that he ran an SS task force of scholars who went through occupied Europe into the libraries of occupied in the universities, and they took out history books. And they didn't burn history books, which is our common conception of what the Nazis did with books they didn't like. They rewrote them. Mm. They rewrote history to reflect properly National Socialist ideology. And this struck me as so astonishing in its not only its detail and its kind of ambition, but also its kind of like perverse approach to history, that I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if you had a situation in which there was an alliance and Rosenberg was given power in England and he decided this rewriting task should be continued, but not about history, but to extend to classic English literature.
Mm. What I felt about Widowland is that it's like an amazing onion. There are so many layers to it in terms of what you could take out of it, because on the one hand, it sort of, I guess, it explores our endless fascination with the what ifs and the what might have been of history. On the other hand, it's a great social story about our relationship with repression and actually how might a brave island nation, the bulldog spirit, have actually coped with a very different set of circumstances. On the other hand, I see it as a telling of the relationship of women with the state and actually what happens in a country hollowed out of men. But I also see it as a story about the truth and about our relationship with the truth. And I suppose, given that I guess you might agree that all of those things are true, are there any of those things that are the real points of emphasis that you draw out?
The way that women behave in Widowland, Rosenberg's instituted a caste system for women, which is something that he did think about, but it's now come to pass, and there's a series of castes, and at the very bottom is the caste of widows and single women over 50 who have no children. And actually, this came from my researches into wartime Germany, in which I was going through the ration allowances for German civilians, and the lowest category of rations, as far as calories were concerned, was a group called Friedhofsfrauen, which means cemetery women, sort of nickname. And they were given very, very low rations because they were worthless. And so that idea that the value of different women in society was something that obviously I was very preoccupied by. Mm. But to get back to your original question, definitely that idea about what is truth and what is history and whether history is what we decide it is and which history we tell ourselves is something that not only obsesses me, I think it obsesses all of us at the moment. In fact, a very recent episode, which is the Meghan and Harry interview with Oprah, where Meghan said, very famously, she said, "I have my own truth." And I think that sentence is fantastically interesting and almost as a culmination to me of a century since Wittgenstein, this idea that truth is no longer objective, such as we had in, such as all, the whole of Enlightenment would tell us, but that truth is now what you say it is. And it was very interesting, and her words have kind of been picked up, and so they've gone into contemporary jargon, and people say, "Well, this is my truth." This is a horror to anyone that has kind of, you know, anyone over the past 300 years who believed there was such a thing as truth, but also a horror to historians, except for the fact that historiographers have long said that history is just whatever.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, but speaking to that point about, you know, my truth, our truths, however, whether the truth is singular or is it based on a number of different perspectives that give you very different vantage points, because the ownership of the truth, I guess, is something that is very important to this novel, specifically in terms of actually the narrated historical story. But it's also something that feels is hugely contested right now. And it's why, you know, people like, I guess, the author Jane Harris has described this book as being the most important feminist novel to be published in decades, because it speaks as much about contemporary tyranny and misogyny as it does about the reimagined past. I mean, when you were writing this, did you have any idea that actually this would become quite a lightning rod novel in terms of actually being a tale as much about our times as it was about that reimagined past?
Oh, I think all historical novels are about our times because they are always filtered through contemporary consciousness. I don't think there is anything as such as a historical novel, because anything that is written in a contemporary setting is a contemporary novel. The subject matter happens to be the past. So, you know, it's quotes a historical novel, but it's really a modern novel. I was very preoccupied with the broad brush Nazi attempts to rewrite the past, because I used them symbolically. Symbolically, I thought that would stand for all sorts of ways that we're rewriting the past at the moment. But I was particularly, the literary side of things, it kind of amused me. I mean, I did think of this novel as a bit of a kind of jeu d'esprit, because it did amuse me that you could have somebody trying to rewrite 19th century literature to take out feisty women or independent women or clever women, because the 19th century novel is all about those particular things. It's women learning to become independent and gaining agency. Jane Eyre, Jane Austen's heroines, they're all about that progress from being powerless to actually getting some kind of power. Mm. So I thought it would be funny to have a protagonist who was trying to kind of dumb down these characters, but in the process, obviously going on her own journey of growth and realizing
But do you reckon, I mean, obviously you put Jane Eyre as the book that changed your life, and actually a book that has influenced your telling of Widowland. But when you were writing Widowland, I suppose in framing the question, I think it was a tweet that you put out at the time when it was described as being a really important piece of feminist literature. When you were writing it, did you see it as such? Because it struck me that you were quite surprised by that description of it in terms of how people have adopted it and have taken it to their hearts.
I did think I'd marinated, as I say, for about a decade in Nazi approaches to women. And what very much interested me was that the Nazis tried very hard to control women. They put a huge amount of detail into the way that they control women in their society. And they had bride schools and mother schools, and you know, you were busy all the time and everything. There was even a fashion bureau, so you had very prescriptive dresses to wear. And so I've always been very interested in that idea of controlling women and how really the relationships between men and women and how men do try and control women in many cases. And so I suppose that did seep into the book that the protagonist's lover is a very unpleasant mansplainer who also is a Sturmbannführer.
A Nazi mansplainer. That really is not a good look, is it?
he's not a good look. But also, to pick up on your earlier point, I was very interested, as I think we all are, in how actually our society would have behaved if there had been an alliance or an occupation. And the funny thing is that I finished Widowland before COVID really kicked off. It was just beginning when I finished it. And so actually I kind of wrote it before COVID, but the whole of lockdown and the pandemic was an illustration to me of actually how quickly people change and how willing people are to obey rules, even if they're random. And in fact, sometimes the more random, the better. How easy it is, as we behaviorists have told us, if you bombard people with random rules that change in a kind of maverick way, people will be more willing to obey.
And accepting a new normal, actually. That one of the things that comes across for those that haven't read the book is the idea that, well, actually, it's a pretty grey world of accepting tyranny, of accepting authoritarian sort of rule over your lives. And I suppose the Churchillian vision of Britain as the, you know, fighting on the beaches to our very last drops of blood is not the telling, Jane, of Britain's relationship in this sort of fictional 1950s setting.
Yeah, although I would hasten to let your listeners know that there is a kind of feisty group of resistance out there who embody everything that we hope would be the case, and that it is a fast-paced thriller in which there's a very climactic end.
So most definitely. But the setting, the backdrop, though, is that that actually there is this sort of the oppression of normality. And I suppose the question then is that, you know, did COVID sort of reassure the thesis that is how we would have responded?
Absolutely. I remember watching a Channel 4 news where there was some point at which some of the regulations had changed about how far you could go from your house and how many people you could talk to, and they did a vox pop and nobody knew what the new rules were. And I'm very interested in that. When I was researching Widowland, I went to the Stasi headquarters, former Stasi headquarters in East Germany, East Berlin. And it's fascinating. Of course, we all know, you know, 9 out of 10 East Germans had some connection with either the Stasi or were informers or unofficial informers. And I've always been very interested in that idea of a surveillance society, which I think we're very much living in at the moment, because and Stasi Germany was that. I think now this is partly why we're so interested in spy fiction, I think, because we're conscious as human beings of how surveilled we are. I mean, partly High Street's supposed to be the highest density of CCTV, I think, outside China. And the level of CCTV surveillance means that we're all consciously or subconsciously aware that we're being watched all the time. And I think that...
And trading our liberty as a consequence.
I think it really impacts. And I think we're facing lots of questions at the moment. For example, the questions around health data and those levels of privacy and vaccination passports. And they're all questions about our relationship with the state and to what extent we should have freedom or we should be effectively serfs of the state. And it's always a slippery slope. That's what I tried to do in Widderland, is show the slippery slope. So Rose's older sister, Celia, says, look, it's not that bad for people like us. You know, it's okay because they're in the top caste and their life is okay. Mm. And that's a very common thing to say. It's not that bad. You know, it could be worse. Look at the people in Europe, you know.
Which is why I think, you know, when you've given us some quotes that go alongside this episode, I think they really do speak to you if you've read the book alongside it. So one is obviously the Jewish scholar Hillel, who's, if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? If I'm not for others, what am I? And if not there, when? I mean, it feels like, you know, this feels like the motif of Widowland, actually, is about when do good people stand up? You know, what are the
moral courage? And so my decade of reading about Nazi Germany and wartime Europe really makes you think about that all the time. I mean, I was sort of studying, I know one of your previous interviews, Anne Sever, studied resistance, SOE resistance women in France. And I have too. And the level of moral courage required to stand up to a brutal police state is immense. But one of the more complicated things that people face now is that things aren't simple. It's not like you've got a policeman banging at your door, going to take you to prison. The courage that's required now is to think for yourself. And sometimes that involves going against widespread opinion. And that's the hard thing. And I don't know the way ahead on that, really.
I mean, obviously, the book also speaks, I mean, just thinking about other themes that come out of it while you're speaking, of course, is that the big theme is the relationship between a state and women in this kind of cast set of characters that you meet along the way. But it's also about men as well in this. And, you know, some are, you know, classic villains. And when Jane Harris talks about misogyny, I mean, there's some nasty characters in there. And there are some very good people there. Yeah. And I suppose the relationship with men, I mean, to me, I was thinking, which may be a sensitive question to ask, is that obviously you've put down as your inspiration your late husband, Philip Kerr. And in terms, I wondered to what degree, when you were writing Widowland, did your own experience help provide, I guess, some of the rawness, some of the passion, some of the feel that just comes across page after page?
If I can tell you a little anecdote, the reason it's called Widowland is that before I wrote this book, shortly after Phil died, I went for lunch with a really old friend, male friend, who I'd been in Fleet Street with. And he said, look, I'm really sorry. We'd love to invite you to dinner. And I said, great, when? And he said, the problem is we only have couples to dinner. And I went away from the lunch and I thought, oh my God, I'm living in a Widowland now.
How did you feel when he said that? How did that hit you?
Well, it was very interesting. If you've been a couple for like 30 years, you live in couple land, you know, and you have the power of two. And it's very interesting overnight, as any widowed men or women will know, to go back to your single status, because everything changes. And initially you think it won't, but it really does. And a sort of invisible wall goes up. And I don't say this in a pitying way, because it's very interesting if you've been married for 30 years to then go back to singlehood again. It's a different way of living, and it's a different experience of life. But it interested me how quickly that happened. And I thought, it was almost like this idea of a caste thing where, you know, this is an invisible wall between us. And I said, this sounds kind of maybe sort of slightly overstated, but it is interesting how differently people are regarded, particularly women, when they're single women from when they're married. And so my widows who live in Widowland is the kind of awful run-down edges of towns, everything's derelict, nobody wants to live there. I did take some of this from what happened in Berlin and Germany, as far as kind of almost ghettos were concerned, but the idea that women who have no function in society are kind of exile to these places. But then I thought, you know, if you've got a group of 50, 60, 70 something women, they're probably going to be the most literate people in society.
Well, this is the thing, because of course, you know, what you see is not ultimately what you get. I mean, the first experience of Widowland, of course, is exactly as you say. It's dark, it's depressing, it's ignored, it feels like people that lack purpose. And of course, as you get to know the widows, you find this sort of incredible group of human beings with so many different life experiences. And I just think you brought it to life beautifully. I mean, obviously, one of the things that you did was to adopt a pseudonym for the first time of C.J. Carey. And this was something of a guess who for a while pre-publication. And in terms of why you did that, was there a reason above and beyond the mystery? I mean, did you think it was going to appeal to perhaps different readers if you didn't write it as a woman, perhaps?
I have to say that's part of it, because it obviously has lots of Nazis in it, and there's quite a lot of men like reading about Nazis, but may not write like reading books which have a kind of woman's name on the cover. So that was an element of it. But it was also really the idea that I've written very, very books set in definitive wartime Europe, and I was trying to be really faithful to detail and dates. And so it felt almost heretical to suddenly just like cast off these shackles of fact and just kind of like write an alternative history. Really pleasurable, actually, I have to say. And so I thought I'd be a different persona for that. And so now,
right. Well, I want to get into that persona, but I don't want to just lose that fact of actually men and the books they read, because I interviewed Marianne Seacart, who basically said it like this. She said, men don't read books by women, and go and check out your own bookshelves if you don't believe me. And I just want to get your response to that. I mean, obviously, over time in history, you know, George Eliot, Marianne Evans, there's a whole history here. I mean, even somebody like, you know, Joanna Rowling, you know, publishers as J.K. Rowling or Robert Galbraith. Do you get depressed by that? Is it getting better? Are there any signals that actually, you know, you can write what you want as a piece of creative imagination, whoever you are? Or actually, is this an area where the winds of change just have not swept through?
The winds of change have totally swept through, in that if you're a woman in publishing at the moment, you are in a good position, not a bad position. The majority of readers of fiction are female. They're the book buyers. So if you're a woman writing fiction, you will find women buy your books. And it's men are in the minority, both as fiction authors and also as fiction buyers. So that's not depressing. I think that it's mildly depressing that in the past that people have had to pretend to be men, and I haven't pretended to be a man, but you do get a wider spread. I'm not as depressed as I should be, because I think that women in publishing at the moment are having a good crack of the whip. And just for the moment, the pendulum has swung and male fiction writers are not having a good crack of the whip. But, you know, the majority of reviews are written by men. The majority of review space is still given to men novels by men, not by women. So you have got that problem. It's not something I feel massively strongly about, but the danger is, as soon as you feminize an industry, then men will inevitably minimize the industry.
So, let's talk about C.J. Carey then. You know, this is your mother's maiden name and your own initials reversed. And you talked about the persona that unleashed. Who is C.J. Carey?
Well, it's fun to have another persona, I can tell you. It's really nice. It's partly because it's kind of like unknown terrain. So I was kind of like nobody knew who I was, and that was good. It's just enjoyable. And the thing about Widowland was it's quite humorous. I tried to... A lot of it made me laugh as I was writing it. For example, when Rose is having to rewrite Jane Eyre, she gets to the point where Jane Eyre meets Bertha Mason, Mr. Rochester's first wife. And I remember reading that when I was about 12 and thinking, actually, you know, it's quite nice that he's looking after his first. She's gone mad. It's actually quite nice that he's still looking after her. And then Rose says, oh, no, that's bad. That's wrong. But when Rose has this reaction, it's totally in alignment with alliance protocol. That is how you're supposed to react, you know. And it's very unfeminine of her then to turn her back on Mr. Rochester and leave him. And it amused me because I know a lot about Goebbels and about the propaganda ministry in Berlin in the 40s. I know how they think and how Goebbels rewrote films and rewrote books and decided what culture would be presented to people and thought it through very, very carefully to make sure that people had the correct attitudes. And I think this is that's something that amused me to do. And I noticed actually this week, for example, the BBC saying it was going to make sure that a lot of soap operas had had storylines about the environment, so mm-hmm. that they shine with the COP26 conference. And that's an example of this similar kind of cultural engineering. Let's make sure we tell people what they should be thinking about generally.
So you don't approve of that?
I think it's heavy-handed. I mean, I think there's no way that you can ignore the fact that zeitgeists exist and people will write about subjects that are interesting to the culture at large. But I think when you get a corporation, for example, deciding that storylines will focus on particular social and cultural issues, you have to tread really carefully.
I've only got a few minutes left. I could go firing down that line, but I just want to just round out the kind of the persona, because it strikes me, reading your lockdown list, is that, you know, you're binging on kind of spy TV, all the John le Carré classics. And, you know, I'm just wondering that, given that you've written, you know, fabulously about, I guess, people that have been in the business of being alternate people, you know, spies just releasing things about themselves, in terms of what writing under this sort of like nom de plume did for you in terms of the creative experience. I mean, you've talked about the humour that actually it brought in. Did it do anything else in terms of, you know, when the guardrails are off and you're not writing as Jane, but you're writing as CJ Carey? Is it a very different style of writing, do you think, that you go through as part of that? And is this part of the inner spy that possibly could have been an alternate career? Because I noticed politician was up there as well as one of the things that you did consider.
It is true. And yes, I think it definitely, what you say is true. And I think I was wondering to myself recently why I'm so interested in writing spy novels and fiction. And I think that idea that I mentioned to you about that feeling of being watched is part of my psychology, this sense of needing some form of anonymity, because the feeling of being watched is quite strong. And I don't know where it comes from. I mean, heavens, nobody's particularly watching me as far as I know, but it's a very interesting, that's so all my heroines have always been very reserved and cautious and watchful. Having said that, I'd be a terrible spy because I'm a massive gossip. When I was at university, I longed to be tapped on the shoulder, and people have since said, you know, I would be literally the last person. I mean, I was already a journalist then, and I wouldn't have been able to make it down the street without telling somebody. So
I actually have a friend that had the tap on the shoulder, and he told everybody in the pub that he'd had it. I mean, it was like he dined out on it forever. Now, just a couple of last questions, if I may, because you've given two wonderful observations. I'm just going to read you your new normal and get you to sort of respond to that. You talked about it being outwardly the same writing desk, looking out at the same trees, but inwardly transformed in the way I perceive and question both my own assumptions and those of society around me. I mean, I just thought, wow, when I read that, in terms of talk about still waters run deep. Pick up the story for us.
I think what we've gone through in the last 18 months, 2 years, has been the most transformative event since the war, in the impact it's had on our social life and our social attitudes. And it certainly caused me to question all sorts of things, question authority. And I think we've seen the gradual collapse of lots of sources of authority, politics and maybe the church. And I think that more and more people are realizing they need to question what's told them. And the rise of big tech is another reason that you have to ask yourself how your preoccupations are being shaped and how your reactions are being shaped as a consumer and as a citizen. And I just think the impact of lockdown and what it did to us and our mental health is very, very serious.
What about the impact on you? Had you know, what are the assumptions that have changed for you personally, do you think?
I hated lockdown. I'm extremely gregarious. I love, you know, socializing. So I really, really hated being deprived of that. But what I also disliked very much was how dehumanizing it is. I hated the fact that people sprung away from each other in the street and people were encouraged to see each other merely as germ carriers. I think that although I wear a mask and have always worn a mask in required circumstances, I think masks are demeaning human beings, and they reduce our humanity. I worried what it did to us, actually. And I think that, without wanting to be doomy, I think the good thing that it did was that it caused us to question more deeply what we believed, what we thought society should be, what we thought our relationship to the state should be. That I think that will be the good that comes out of it. But I think there will be, there's really deep trauma. I don't want to end on a doomy note here, but
don't worry, I'm going to have an uplifting one in a minute. But I'm with you.
Well, what I was going to say is that, having been with my husband during his dying and his death, what people must feel who were not allowed to be with their spouse or maybe their child while that person was dying, I think the level of buried trauma and probably rage is and grief is extraordinary, and it hasn't been able to express itself.
And I think that need for expression is why trying to just understand this through the lens of immediacy probably misses the point that this has still got many chapters to play out, especially on the social experience. Now, I did promise to end us on an uplifting idea. And of course, I thought your tip for life was wonderfully uplifting. I'll just read it for you. Say yes, make connections, go out even when you don't feel like it. Serendipity shapes lives, and life is short, so maximize your opportunity. A final thought, Jane.
Well, be a party person, you know, be as many people as you can. I spent a life in journalism. It was literally hardly like work. It was so much fun. And I sometimes feel sorry for my children setting out on jobs that are kind of like not journalism, because it was like being at a 24-hour party. And I always think you should take every opportunity that comes your way.
I'm sure your fellow journalist or former journalist colleagues saying, don't tell them it's like a 24-hour party. But I am actually going to use my journalistic largesse for a final second, because I suppose the question that I haven't asked you that Widowland fans will want to know is, does the story go on? Is there going to be a sequel?
There is a sequel. I've just finished it. It's called Queen High. And it's set 3 years after the events of Widowland. So it's set in 1956. All I can say is I've had a lot of fun channeling recent royal events in my reflection of 1956. And it's actually a lot about memory and what we remember. Something very big happens at the end of Widowland. But I'm very preoccupied by the fact that we forget very quickly, and not only places like China, where you're not allowed to mention the date of Tiananmen Square, but also actually Germany, where people very quickly forgot the existence of Auschwitz and had to be reminded of it. And so it's all about memory.
Well, if that doesn't tee up appetite for the second telling of Widowland, when will it be published, Jane? Just as a...
It comes out next September 22.
Well, there we have it, September 22. Jane Fine, thank you so much for joining me on Changemakers.
Oh, thank you, Michael. That's so much fun. Thank you.
Changemakers is brought to you by the campaign's firm Seven Hills and presented by me, Michael Heyman. Pure Being is the name of our soundtrack, and it's written and performed by the brilliant BT Wolf. To find out more, head over to changemakers.works, and if you like what you hear, why not give us a rating?